Let's do this. Woo! Ring the bell. This is Between the Ropes.
Oh, you're going for the dirt, for the behind-the-scenes stuff.
It's time to get Between the Ropes. Between the Ropes.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining in. This is the Between the Ropes podcast. Brian Fritz, along with a guy who's traveling the roads of North Kakalaki, as they like to call it. He likes big, sweaty men, Michael Wiseman.
Big, sweaty men. My God, that was an awkward segment, huh?
That was beyond an awkward segment on Raw.
Dear Lord. Yeah, so I'm out on the road again tonight. So, as you know, we've been looking for JTG, right?
Yes.
Okay.
We're not looking anymore.
Okay, so let's clarify something. You found JTG on Sunday while we were in New York for SummerSlam, correct?
I did. I found JTG. I have a picture with him.
Right, and I was not there, unfortunately. I was getting to the arena another way and did not make it to see JTG with you.
Yep.
And so I said, what the heck? Let me, we had to fly out Monday, whatever, had plane tickets, blah, blah, blah. I said, let me drive back up to where JTG was last seen and see if I can find him for myself. So I'm on the hunt, you know.
Well, good for you,
playing a little Pokemon Go. I want to try to catch JTG in one of those Pokeballs and then I'll use them to fight other pro wrestlers in WWE Supercards. So,
well, now
that's how all that stuff works, right?
Now that me and JTG are BFFs, uh-huh. I can tell you right now you're looking in the wrong spot because I know for a fact he's in Boston right now.
Damn it. Okay, so I need to pull a U-turn up here at this next ramp.
Yes.
And head west. Got it.
You probably want to go north.
Okay, I'll go north after I go west.
Sure, why not?
Go north. Sure. All great advice. I'll get there.
Just so everybody knows, normally we talk about what Michael is drinking on any given show, but uh-huh. That will not be happening tonight.
Right, because they could use that as evidence against me in a court of law.
Unless you're enjoying a nice frosty soda or a refreshing bottle of water.
Of course, this clear liquid in my flask is definitely water. Yes, if anybody is listening, NSA, this is water and not vodka.
Put that in the back seat. Take that someplace away from you.
I always carry my water in a brown paper bag. Yes, of course. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay, so we did the podcast over the weekend that came out on, what was it, Saturday? Talking
Sunday.
About
Sunday.
Talking
Sunday, about, Sunday, Sunday.
So we were talking about NXT, and we reviewed NXT, and we did a little bit more of a preview when it came to SummerSlam. We had a little discussion about something in particular, and I want you to enjoy this moment because this is going to be a rarity, okay? I am going to apologize for something that I said on that podcast.
Wow. Okay. Which, by the way, if you're listening for NXT results and our opinions on that, please go back and check out Sunday's podcast. This is my cheap plug. They're all there on Sunday. We will not be talking about NXT TakeOver and the glorious one, Bobby Roode.
Right. We're not going to be talking about that. And by the way, when it comes to the podcast, of course, you can find the podcast on iTunes or on Stitcher. Please rate and review the podcast. We're also on SoundCloud. We're on the TuneIn app, and we're on Google Play as well, so you can listen to all those different places. And don't miss out on the video interviews that we did on Friday night from the SummerSlam kickoff party presented by WWE 2K17. Interviews with the likes of AJ Styles, Bill Goldberg, Sasha Banks, Shinsuke Nakamura, Sheamus. They're all up on the website. And your good buddy.
Harley Howe.
That's
Harley
right.
Howe, WWE Supercard.
Yes. But anyway, I need to apologize about something that was said on that podcast.
Okay, this is a first. So yeah,
this
please,
is a first, so
pull out your recording devices.
Yes,
we'll
everybody.
Get this on tape.
We had a discussion about entrance music, and you are right. The best entrance music in the WWE right now is the glorious song for Bobby Roode.
Yes. Yes.
I debated it a little bit, talking about Shinsuke Nakamura, which, hey, you know what? If everybody likes, you know, it's your own opinion. But now that I have the glorious song on my phone, I keep listening to the damn thing. And it's just so catchy. And yeah, you're right. It's the best song in WWE right now.
I've been singing that song for 4 days straight now. Like yesterday, I was having a super stressful day, and I literally just kept singing his theme music in my head, and it made me feel better. So there you go.
It's so wonderful.
I get it, right? Saturday night, we had two great entrances. Bobby Roode's was fantastic. Shinsuke Nakamura's was fantastic. And I got home, and my wife does not watch NXT, but I made her watch those two entrances. And I got to tell you something. That Shinsuke Nakamura entrance still gave me goosebumps. It's just so amazing. The string, the music, the lighting, everything was just perfect. But again, the Glorious One, that's a real song right there.
It's funny you say that because I told my wife she needed to see this entrance, and she's not a wrestling fan at all. And I told her she needed to see the Nakamura entrance because of the violin and everything. So I turned on the feed, and I must have been watching sometime on the weekend because I go to my feed on WWE Network for that show, and it was right at the beginning of Bobby Roode's entrance. And I go, wait a second, you got to watch this first. And she's like, I don't want to watch this. And I made her watch Bobby Roode's entrance.
That's awesome.
But then we watched Nakamura, which she liked a lot more. She liked the violin. But yeah, it was spectacular the way they were able to do those entrances. It's funny because we saw the production and we saw how much detail was put into those. Yet we didn't see that kind of over-the-top entrance the following night when it came to SummerSlam.
Sure. Bailey did not have a... Yeah, she wasn't... Let's see, her entrance was not quite over the top, but...
Well, Bailey wasn't until Monday night, but Sunday night...
Right.
Yeah.
And then, so I think Sunday night, I was thinking if hers was a little more low-key, a little more normal, but so Sunday night didn't have anybody that was that crazy.
No.
I mean, did they?
No. Nobody really had a crazy entrance. Nobody did at all, so... I mean, they just kind of, the set looked really nice, but they didn't do anything above and beyond the set. Like, they didn't do anything when it came to anything special props that were out there or special lighting or anything like that, which is fine. I mean,
there were no tanks for Rusev. Rusev did not come out of the tank, unfortunately.
Man, if they got to do that again 1 year, man, he needs the tank.
Right.
Okay. So,
right.
Now, my impression for SummerSlam, and we'll just talk briefly about SummerSlam, and then we'll get into Raw and SmackDown and some of the other news, and there's a lot of other news to get into for the week. But SummerSlam, I thought there was big expectations. And going into the weekend, I really thought it was going to be the better of the two shows and compared to NXT. And NXT was the better show from top to bottom. I mean, SummerSlam was still solid, if not good. It just didn't hit that high note that I thought it was going to do. And I guess I was a little bit disappointed. A lot of that is just because of the ultra-high expectations I had for the show.
You are a lot nicer about this than I'm about to be. So I want to apologize for something, too, because I made the bold statement that I think this year's NXT TakeOver might have been better than last year's TakeOver. And I went back, and I also kind of dissed the Bayley-Asuka match, and I think that match Saturday night was better than I initially gave it credit for, but... Neck and neck, I still might give the nod to last year's NXT TakeOver. That being said, we both felt fairly confident SummerSlam was still going to be better than TakeOver because of the way they had booked the card. You had all this talent, all these big storylines culminating, et cetera, et cetera. I thought Sunday night's show was average. I think the set was pretty cool, but I felt like there were a lot of missed opportunities Saturday night, and I think or Sunday night, and I think the way the fans reacted in Brooklyn reflect my opinion. You had a few good matches on there. We talk about the AJ Styles-John Cena match being an instant classic, and it is. It is my early contender for match of the year so far. But I think a lot of things hurt that show. I think the women's match kind of being a little bit of a, not a botch fest, but just some bad spots in there and some really dangerous spots killed the momentum of that match, and it killed it in my mind. I don't really like that match. And I think the Ambrose-Dolph Ziggler match was a huge missed opportunity, and we talked about this, but that whole card, the way they booked a four-hour show with all of those breaks and all of those big matches, small matches, it kills the momentum of a show, and I think it wears the audience out more. You just... you can't bring an audience and make them feel really high and then go 30, 40 minutes and not do that, give them a New Day segment or a Six Divas tag match or whatever. It kills the audience's expectations, whereas Saturday night, you had an hour or two of solid matches that built towards the main event. You know, we were talking with Shoemaker after the event Sunday night, ran into him at a bar, and basically having the conversation, he said, you know, they do video packages now to give the audience a chance to breathe, and those go 20 minutes with the backstage segments and commercials and whatever. That's plenty enough time. We don't need to go an hour in between big matches. So there were some good matches, Balor, Rollins, AJ Styles, Cena, obviously, but the spaces in between those matches and then the weird finish, it just was a very interesting, not in a good way necessarily, night for WWE.
Well, you know, I think that's something that they have to look at, because there's always been the talk of, you know, people get up for a match, then you want to bring them back down just a little bit. You want to have that buffer match, so to speak, because otherwise, if you stack all the main events against one another, could that kill the momentum of the show? Does it kill the crowd out? Do they get tired or whatnot? You know what? At this point, you might as well do that. When it comes to the importance of the matches, do that all in a row and do it to close out a show, especially now because the shows are longer for a show like SummerSlam. So you're already asking a crowd to go for 4 hours plus for the main show. And then if you want to throw in the pre-show, you're talking another 2 hours, even though there was only a few matches there. And that's very staggered in how they do those matches because of how much time that they have to fill up. So they probably do need to start with maybe one pretty good hot match or whatever they want to do, and then build the rest of the card up to where you do the, you know, 2, 3, 4 main events all in a row, because that's what people came to see the show for. No matter what sells pay-per-views, what sells these events are the biggest matches. So I think that's something they have to look at, especially when it comes to the longer shows like a SummerSlam and like a WrestleMania. That's what people want to see. They want to be up for those big matches and the biggest stars. So, you know what? Stack them all in a row at the end of the show rather than staggering them. I really think they have to get away from that formula.
I agree. And you see, UFC does this. Obviously, they're a different kind of beast. But UFC does this with their cards, and they do perfectly fine with it. Yeah. And I think if you take those top four matches, Lesnar, Orton, Rollins versus Balor, Ambrose versus Ziggler, and then AJ Styles versus John Cena, and you go with them in that reverse order that I just did, you would have been fine, because you're still building in excitement and momentum. And the thing about it for the fans is, maybe I'm not looking forward to Ziggler and Ambrose for whatever reason, but it's still getting me more and more excited for the match that I am looking forward to in Balor, Rollins, or whoever. And you just buy in the fans who might be casually interested. Whereas I start checking out, you're going to have to draw my attention back in. And I think, unfortunately, Rollins and Balor suffered the worst for that, because their match was fantastic, and the crowd was just zoned out after a mediocre showing from Ambrose and Ziggler and the Divas match. So, again, also, I'm old school like this, but your biggest, most important championship should go on last, or at the very least, next to last, against an attraction main event like what Randy Orton and Brock Lesnar was supposed to be. Instead, we got this U.S. title match as the quote-unquote co-main event. What kind of hot garbage is that? Get off my lawn. It's garbage.
I don't think it was a co-main event. I just think it was the match that went on before the final match. And, I mean, there's a difference to that, but it goes to the argument of these staggering matches, because they're bringing everybody down and they're going to build you back up. And they did it in that way in particular because they knew that was never even going to be a match. That was never even going to start. So real quick, let's talk about some of the particulars here. Let's start with the main event. So we know the finish. It was Brock Lesnar getting a TKO victory against Randy Orton, you know, late in the match. They were in the ring. Lesnar takes off his gloves and he starts pounding away on Orton. He's giving him some ground and pound in the middle of the ring. Come to find out, this was in fact the planned finish. What was not planned was the way that Lesnar roughed him up, from a standpoint of maybe he was going to get him a little bit of blood, but he opened a hellacious cut on Orton's head, which we were sitting kind of far away from it, and I could see it plain as day. He was so bloody. He hit him with an elbow that ripped him open. Orton was bleeding everywhere. There was just a pool of blood, and he required 10 staples for the cut. And that was how they finished. It was just kind of this awkward ending where they finally said Orton can't continue. Lesnar kept jumping in and kept punching him more and more, but you could tell he was really protecting Orton with those punches. He just kept doing that more and more. Finally, the referees just kind of awkwardly, you know, got the timekeeper to ring the bell. He said, match is over. Lesnar wins by TKO. Shane McMahon comes out and he wants to take a look at Orton. Lesnar keeps stepping in his way, finally gives him an F5. And that's how they end the show, is with those guys laying down in the ring. Orton's finally starting to get up and staggering off. But, you know, he's just a bloody mess. And then Shane's, you know, taking the F5. And it's this weird kind of finish to the show. And it's, quite honestly, very similar to last year's SummerSlam from the standpoint there was that disputed finish between Taker and Lesnar. That was very awkward. And it was something that a lot of people didn't pick up on, especially people there in the building. And once again, it's WWE saying, we're going to do something in the show that's going to look real, that's going to look disputed or look different than we normally have. And it's going to be a talking point for a lot of people. It's just, I think the question is that really a good thing when you finish it like that? And also, even though I know they probably didn't want that much blood, but should you really be trying to rip a guy open and make him bleed by having another human being, especially when the size of Brock Lesnar, hit him with elbows until he cuts him open?
The hard way. The really hard way.
The really, really hard way, yeah.
Brock Lesnar must have been super pissed by Sam Roberts questioning on Friday night to have that much aggression still in him on Sunday.
Yeah.
He's like, what's the haps? I'm going to show you what the haps is. Oh, my Lord. That was a weird finish, and I think it undercut the attraction, right? Because you talk about this being something they've built towards for so long, and you expect there to be, like in UFC, you have knockouts on a regular basis. So when knockouts happen, that's a way a match can end or a fight can end. In WWE, it doesn't happen that way, so it makes fans feel like it's incomplete. And I think that's the issue with it, is fans feel like that big attraction fight that they've been building towards for a month and a half, I'm going to assume most of them felt like that was almost a non-finish. When you had the non-finish earlier in the night between New Day and The Click, or the club, sorry, they do the little hand motion like The Click.
Too sweet, club, baby.
You kind of leave the fans feeling like they didn't get what they expected. And I get it sometimes. You're going to have non-finishes. But this match felt very much like they were building this feud towards a one-match thing, right? And that was going to be Orton-Lesnar, SummerSlam, first time ever, and possibly the last time ever. And they didn't even conclude it in a way that makes sense. So, I don't know. You know, last year with Lesnar-Taker, I got it because I kind of figured they were building towards a rematch at Hell in a Cell, and I said that. I was like, they're going towards Hell in a Cell. This year, it seemed unnecessary. It seemed like they were trying to put Brock over big without having Orton actually lose his big comeback match. So, I don't know. It was a decent spectacle, and it made Brock look like a total beast, but Randy Orton had to get 12 staples. That's dangerous. And it just left a sour taste in fans' mouth. Of course, the Brooklyn fans really wanted to see Bill Goldberg, so I think that was why they were actually booing at the end of the night. But still, it felt very much like a non-finish.
Yeah, no Goldberg. I don't know if it was ever planned or not, or they tried to get him for the show. Who knows as of right now? But, you know, he had said to us and to other people, you know, in the interview that I talked about that we did, he had said, hey, man, the ball's in their court. You know, but right. I don't know if that means, who knows if they were ever really planning on having him here, or even if they are looking to sign him, maybe that's for down the line. I mean, because the storyline here is going to be, so Shane McMahon's pissed that Randy Orton got roughed up the way that he did. And Stephanie swore that there would be ramifications for Brock Lesnar's actions. And those ramifications were a $500 fine, okay? Which is something that you and I could even pay. Okay, so that's how weak it is.
Yes.
So, You know, and that was done on purpose. And they're playing that in storyline where Shane McMahon's like, there's going to be more to this. We know that's a light find. We know this is ridiculous. So they are setting up Shane McMahon versus Brock Lesnar. I don't know if it'll be Survivor Series. I don't know if it'll be the Royal Rumble. It feels like it's going to be one of those two.
Is that the direction you think they're heading? They're going to have Shane McMahon fight Brock Lesnar?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
No.
Yes. Because here's the way that I think they go.
No.
Yes. God. I'm serious. I think that they're going to do that match. I think Brock is going to beat the living hell out of him and like go above and beyond to where they say, okay, now we got to bring in a ringer. Now we got to bring in somebody that's really going to stand toe to toe and fight you. And that somebody is going to be Goldberg.
Well, that's the direction I thought they were going with Shane McMahon, right? Shane McMahon takes an F5 and says, oh, you have your beast? I'm going to have my beast. He went undefeated for however many hundred matches, and then he brings in Goldberg. I don't think there's any... Maybe I'm wrong, but I think there's little to no money in having Shane McMahon fight Brock Lesnar, right? We saw that attraction fight with Shane McMahon and The Undertaker, and it was fun, and it was a spectacle, but Brock Lesnar is not that kind of spectacle. He just beats people up, and this match will literally be exactly that.
I know, but I think they're going to do it. I just have this feeling that that's the direction they're going to go. We'll see if that's what they do, but you know, when it comes to that finish, though, I understand they're trying to get people buzzing. They're trying to do something different. I don't know if it works or not, though. I mean, they've done it a couple of years in a row now. Remember, 2 years ago, it was Lesnar, you know, inventing Suplex City and just throwing John Cena around like a rag doll and dominating him in that match. And then last year, the finish with Taker. So, you know, I don't know if that's something they want to keep doing. They're trying to make Lesnar into the special attraction, which I get. It's just that, like you said, we're not used to that kind of finish. And then on top of that, just how violent, how bloody it ended up turning out. I mean, that's a whole nother story, too.
Like what they've done is they've kind of gone to the well so many times on that kind of Brock Lesnar match. When Lesnar first came back, he had some really good matches with some people, right? John Cena and him had a very brutal match at Extreme Rules that first time. Brock Lesnar had a great series with Triple H. A couple of really solid matches in there. That match he had with CM Punk at SummerSlam, I think it was about 4 years ago, was a really, really good match. But right around the time that tide kind of switched with the John Cena thing and Suplex City, I feel like his matches have become very one-note. Now, he's had some good... The Seth Rollins, Brock Lesnar, John Cena match from Royal Rumble last year was excellent, right? Mm-hmm. It's not saying Brock Lesnar doesn't have good matches, but what they've gone to time and time again, and it was like this on Sunday, Suplex City, beat him up, okay, we get a little bit of offense in, but I still win. And it seems very one-note for him at this point.
Well, I mean, they've got to find a way to protect him but still make him look strong. So, you know, there's a certain style that they do with Brock, and it's worked so far. It's just, can it continue to work, and what can they make a little bit different that makes it fresh? Real quick, the rest of SummerSlam. John Cena and AJ Styles, like you said, an instant classic. Arguably the best match of the year, especially when it comes to WWE. And I said this last night while I was watching SmackDown, with the match that he was having with Ziggler, and then, you know, everything that AJ has done over the last few years, but especially when you talk about what he's done in WWE. To me, there is no doubt that AJ Styles is the best wrestler walking God's green earth right now.
Ooh, that's a bold claim.
To me, there is no question. There is some very, very good talent around.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to besmirch anybody else, whether you want to say Shinsuke Nakamura, whether you want to say Seth Rollins, whether you want to say Kenny Omega, no matter who else you want to say, there's a lot of talent that's out there. AJ Styles is the best wrestler in the world.
Well, and you're basing that based off of mostly in-ring skills, right? Because I think AJ does good on the mic, but he could get better.
I'm talking about he's the best in-ring performer in the world.
Especially if you compare him to Rollins and Shinsuke, I would have to agree. I think there's something about AJ where he has a really unique offense, but he does it in a very crisp way. He doesn't mess up. He doesn't have mistakes. and he's able to deliver night in and night out consistently, more consistently than Rollins or even Nakamura. He's just always perfection. I like Rollins. I think his style is a little bit not reckless, but a little bit dangerous sometimes. So I think AJ's got that. But I got to give props to John Cena here. I'm not calling him the best in-ring technician or the best technical wrestler or any of that jazz, but when's the last time John Cena had a bad match?
It's been a while, man. I mean, the last couple of years especially. Now, I know some people will make the argument, well, look who he's been in the ring with. They've been tremendous talents. But you know what? Cena has been just as good. Cena has stepped up to the plate. I think that when people talk about John Cena from years ago, or even just a few years ago, they were not giving him the proper credit. But now, there's no denying you have to give the man credit of how good he has been, because while he's not, you know, flying all over the place, while he's not doing the most complex moves, he knows when to hit the right note. He knows how to sell. His timing is fantastic. And the way that he's able to work these matches with guys, it's this give and take, and he's great in there, playing off of the other person.
I mean, even if you excuse the fact that John Cena's been putting a lot of guys over in recent months and even in the last year, that's a big thing for me. But it seemed like if you go back 10 years when he had that feud with Orton, they had all that last man standing match and all that stuff, he just had this kind of brawler style, similar to Austin, but even less technical than that, where he did a lot of punches, did a lot of kicks, did a lot of rest holds. And it seemed like right around the time he had that great feud with Daniel Bryan over the championship, and Daniel Bryan won, he really started upping his game and changing the way he approached matches, and the psychology is fantastic. It's no longer... See, people hate Cena because of Super Cena, right? Cena gets beat down, and then he comes back up and wins. But he has changed the psychology of these matches so much that it's very impressive to me as a long-time pro wrestling watcher. And you're right, the talent he's been in the ring with has been fantastic. But we've seen plenty of times... I'm going to call Sasha Banks and Charlotte here, two great wrestlers who did not match up very well at all on Sunday. There was no chemistry. So, again, you've got to make that happen sometimes. And John Cena has been one heck of an opponent for a lot of great talents and given us some great feuds and, most importantly, some all-time great matches in the last couple of years.
When it comes to Sasha and Charlotte, here's the problem, okay? I don't know. I mean, they've had great matches before, so I can't blame it on the chemistry. I think what I can blame it on is twofold. Number one, apparently Sasha Banks went into that match with a bad back. So she already had an injury. Then two, early on in that match, there was a botch to where Charlotte was jumping off the ropes and she had Sasha with her, and there was a slip. And Charlotte let go of Sasha, and she took a wicked bump on her back and her neck. And, I mean, it was scary as all hell. And Sasha was shaken up after that. The next series of moves that they did was mistimed, and they had to do it a couple of times, a sequence or whatever. And by the end of the match, they got it back. They got the crowd back. Crowd was, you know, really wanted to get into this match. And they got it back. But it was never the same as it was at the beginning. And they had to spend a lot of the match to get it back. And we, like I said, we find out afterwards that, you know, Sasha is injured. I don't think she's going to be out a month, but she could be out a month. She's going to be out for like 2 to 4 weeks, no surgery. But she's dealing with another injury, unfortunately. And because of that, there was a surprise of the night in the fact that she ended up losing, and Charlotte's the women's champion again. So I think that was just one of those weird circumstances where, you know, you go in there, you got an injury, something bad happens early on, and it just throws you off. It threw off their timing. I think it threw off their mentality a little bit, and they spent the rest of the match just trying to get it back on track.
Well, and I think they have to get over this mentality of, if you hear them in interviews, you always hear them talking about how they're going to go out there and one-up what they've done before, and how this is going to be, we're going to one-up everything we've done. And they say that so much, I just wish they would get the mentality of, let's go out there and have a great match and let that match speak for itself. We've had great matches in the past. Let's go out there and have a great match tonight. You know, you didn't hear John Cena and AJ Styles saying, our match is going to be better than it was a month ago. They just went out there and had a fantastic match, and it was the match of the night. So I wish they would quit trying. It feels like they're trying a little bit too hard to come up with big spots to really prove that this match was better than the last one. Just go out there and have a solid match and build from that. And you will steal the show by doing only that.
Let's real quickly talk about the two world championship matches. So you mentioned Balor against Rollins, the Demon King. Balor went out. He won the match. And what turned out to be a very, very good match. The problem was, before the match, Mick Foley and Stephanie McMahon unveiled the new Universal Championship. And Mick even joked about how much time and effort went into this design and whatnot. And it was the same exact design as the WWE Championship. The only difference was it was all red. And the crowd crapped on it immediately. And it totally hijacked the match. And for the first half of the match, the Brooklyn crowd kept coming up with different chants, bad-mouthing the belt. Anytime that the camera showed the belt, which was at ringside, the crowd immediately booed. And it had to have been tough for Balor and for Rollins to work through that. They did the best that they could. Plus, on top of that, as we find out later, Balor was injured during the match when he got thrown into the dasher boards and his right arm went over it, and come to find out, he popped his shoulder out and he popped it back in, but he tore his labrum as well. So, and he knew it was a pretty bad injury. And then we found out on Monday, torn labrum, and we'll get into that in a minute. So they were you know, fighting a lot through this match. They ended up having a really good match despite the crowd not really getting into it until the end. And, you know, I felt bad because, I mean, you're talking about two guys that worked extremely hard to put on this performance in what was supposed to be an incredible night for Balor in particular, from the standpoint that he's finally on the main roster after waiting for so long. And this is his crowning moment that he is going to be the champion. He's going to be the first ever Universal Champion. He's going to, you know, be a main player on Raw, and he's going to beat cleanly a guy of the level of Seth Rollins. And then come to find out, too, his family is there at ringside. They've flown in from Ireland, and the crowd just, all they cared about was hating that championship belt.
I don't understand what everybody's all upset about. That belt is obviously made of pure Twizzlers, so not only is it a great championship, it makes for a tasty snack after you get done wrestling. So
somebody did a mock-up of it, and they said if you take the black, or you take the red belt off the back and you replace it with black and leave everything else the same because the middle of it's red and everything, it looks really great.
Yep. Like they did with the SmackDown Women's Championship, right? The same white belt they used for the Raw one, except they've replaced the red with the blue. That's all you had to do.
Yep.
And oh, well,
it's tough because, I mean, like I said, they went out there and they tore it up, man. They did the best they could. They probably had, I think they had the second best match of the night. And, you know, that's the way the crowd reacted. Now, the other heavyweight championship match, which I know got under your skin.
And I think, I mean, I can use that, I know you said this, but I just want to, again, those guys, you could tell in the arena, they worked so hard to get that crowd back into it. And they accomplished that by the end of the match. But kudos to them for fighting through it. And even though it didn't play out on Monday night the way we wanted it to, I have to really give the WWE creative team credit for doing something really special with that match. It was a very special moment for Finn Balor to win that title and for them to give him that moment after, I doubted it. I did not think they would put the belt on him right now. And so for him to win that championship, I think that was a really incredible seal of approval from WWE. So, again, kudos to everybody involved. Sorry you don't like the belt, fans, but get over it.
Notice how I haven't even thrown it in your face that I was right about both of the heavyweight championship matches and who was going to win. Oh, wait, I just did.
So, what about that Ambrose-Ziggler match? God, that was a...
Okay, so that match, it went a lot shorter than we thought. And Ambrose got most of the offense in that match. And even at the end, like, he hit Dirty Deeds, and then he gave this reaction like, yep, I knew it. And he had like this little cocky look at the camera, like, got him, no problem, business taken care of. And then he covered him and got the pin. And I know that on SmackDown they were talking about Dolph Ziggler came so close and blah, blah, blah. But, man, Ambrose, he controlled most of that match, and it turned out to not be anything special of a match.
Yep, that was very disappointing. Those guys should have had... I was hoping they would have great chemistry. They did not. The match felt very one-note. It felt very dead. The crowd was not into it at all. They were just sitting on their hands. And I know some people want to blame Ambrose's offensive style and say he's not very exciting and whatever have you. I think the creative team did a great job of building up Dolph Ziggler to make him a credible contender and a credible opponent for Ambrose. So I don't understand why they essentially squashed him and sent him back down the card to not jobber status, but mid-card hell at the very least. Why would you do that story and then ruin it in that way? I don't get it. I don't get it.
Good question, man. So, yeah, that was SummerSlam. It was underwhelming, unfortunately. And then, you know, everybody, especially Finn Balor, got the sucker punch the next day. Come to find out he's injured. MRI shows torn labrum. He had surgery, which was successful, but he's going to be out for 4 to 6 months, and he had to relinquish the championship on Monday. So that sucks, man. Just the first night, title's gone. The only good thing that I can say out of this is if his recovery goes as expected, he'll be back in time for WrestleMania. So
sure.
Maybe that's where you do Balor against Rollins or whoever the champion is. I mean, I think everybody expects it to be Seth. I don't know that for a fact yet, but, I mean, we'll see how it plays out. But, you know, it stinks that it happened to Balor, but, I mean, in that manner. But hopefully he can be back in time for Mania and get him right back on track and they go from there.
You always worry. It's like with Daniel Bryan when he got injured, right?
Yeah.
You always worry that that you lose the opportunity. For somebody like Balor, not that Balor is not talented, but his size is always going to be a factor. I mean, he's not big enough to be a World Heavyweight Champion, according to Ric Flair. So that's always a concern. I hope that WWE is able to see past this and still give him that spot, even if it's not just, oh, look, we're a new brand and we want to do something hot and fresh and exciting. I hope they can still see him as their world champion in 2017.
It's funny that we make the joke about Flair because he did say that, but... WWE.com had all these videos of, you know, kind of, you know, a diary of Finn Balor. And one of them was he ran into Ric Flair before the show. And Ric was like, hey, man, what's going on? And Ric gave him a big hug. And, you know, so I don't think there's any hard feelings going on between the two of them in any shape.
He probably needed it alone, you know, with Flair. Probably.
So, kid, how much money you get invested in the bank?
Yeah. I hope you become champion tonight so I can bum some money off of
yeah.
you.
Yeah. So, on Raw, they had to set up, a tournament, a small tournament, or not even a tournament. They did qualifying matches. So, they set up 4 different qualifying matches with the winners facing one another in a fatal 4-way next week on Raw to crown a new Universal Champion. So, the winners were... We got Roman Reigns, who beat Rusev when Rusev walked off with his injured ribs. Oh, I'm sorry. Roman Reigns beat Chris Jericho, excuse me. And that was the final match on the show. So, he advanced. We also got Seth Rollins, who beat Sami Zayn. And Zayn was selling a sprained ankle, and Rollins is working it over, and he got the win. More about that in a second. Rusev and Big Cass. Big Cass won. Rusev just said, screw it. My ribs are injured. I'm going to walk off. And he was out of there. And Kevin Owens also qualified by beating Neville. So those will be
which was a very odd inclusion. We have all of these guys.
Yeah.
And instead of including Cesaro or Sheamus, we're going to include Neville.
Well, that was the whole thing that I was thinking, too, was I know that Sheamus and Cesaro are involved in this best of 7 series. But you know what? When they do this segment at the beginning of the show and all these people are coming down saying, I want the championship. I want to shout the championship. It seems ridiculous if somebody doesn't come out there. And it was really ridiculous that it wasn't Cesaro and Sheamus, you know, for both of them to not be there. I mean, it's just like, even if they get shut down and there's got to be a good way to shut them down and just say, hey, you know what? Here's what we're going to do with you guys. You're not going to be in this, but the winner of your best of seven will automatically get a world championship shot.
Well, they did. Oh, so I did read online. Apparently, they said that. Apparently, they said the winner of that match or that series is going to get a WWE championship shot. Now, I don't know if it was clarified that it's for the Universal title.
They never did. They just said they're getting a championship match.
But you would assume if you win a best of seven series against the other setting, it should be for the Universal title. But I don't know.
Who knows? But I want to bring up one point about this, about all these different things. So Rusev on Sunday, he never had the match with Reigns. The Reigns beat him up before the match, and then while Rusev was rolling around in pain and finally got up with his bruised ribs, Rusev did the long run down the ramp and he speared him in a fantastic spot, right? Here's the thing I want to bring up. So Rusev selling the ribs, does it the next night. Sami Zayn, in the middle of the match, acts like he sprained his ankle to the point where people are like, oh my God, now Sami is injured. Looks like he is fine. He was just selling the entire match.
Right.
Saturday night in NXT, Samoa Joe against Shinsuke Nakamura. What happened late in the match? Nakamura hit his finisher, couldn't finish up, and then Joe sold it. Like he got hit in the face with a bag of bricks, right? And he goes down, and then he gets hit with it a second time, and he gets pinned. And I know Joe has gone on social media and said that he had like a dislocated jaw or whatever. I'm going to tell you right now, I don't know this for fact, but I feel 99.9% sure that's garbage. And that is Joe selling. Because you're talking about some old school guys right here. And this is
right.
Something we haven't seen for a while in WWE in particular. We talk about, in the middle of a match, a guy will get his leg worked on, and the next thing you know, he's running perfectly. But you're talking about three guys in particular here that are doing an incredible job of selling, not just from one night, but they're carrying it over, especially in the case of Rusev. And it just shows how much that adds to matches and storylines of these guys selling and the believability, especially when it comes to Joe and Zayn, to where people have bought in hook, line, and sinker, that
yep.
these guys were really injured, which is fantastic that they get people believing like this.
I think it's a testament to how WWE style has changed in the last couple of years in regards to storylines. They're kind of trying to carry over a little bit more authenticity into it. And I think even with the in-ring style, the psychology has changed a lot. I'm telling you, around 2009, 2010, the in-ring psychology style of WWE was, let's do a lot of bumps, like these, not like fancy bumps, but off the ropes, clothesline, power slams, maybe we'll do a spot off the top rope. But it wasn't designed in a way to build towards anything, and it wasn't designed to kind of have that aggressive style that selling a leg would attribute to it. It was just like, oh, we did some moves, right? It was everything was the five moves of doom. So I'm glad that they've reincorporated that realism because it really sells the story, it sells the match, and it really sells the wrestlers as well themselves. So, I love it.
Yeah, I love it.
I was convinced. Zayn was injured in my mind. I was like, crap, it happened. He did a great job.
He did a fantastic job, and I questioned it for a second, and I was thinking, nope. Even when they showed the replay, I think that's just the brilliance of Sami Zayn, that he did that on purpose. Because I think it was like a leapfrog or whatever it was, that he just kind of, twisted his ankle in this manner that he knew that, hey, just by doing that tweak and going down, people are going to buy it. And people bought it. So we also saw the official call-up of Bayley to the main roster, which I don't know if she would have been in the title match this soon or the title picture, but I think she was going to get called up here following her loss on Saturday to Asuka. But so Mick Foley introduced her. Charlotte was bragging about how she beat Sasha, exposed her for being all flash, no cash. And Mick Foley came out and said, hey, you know what? I got the hottest free agent for the division. It's Heath Slater in the wig. No, it was Bayley. So Bayley got to come out, and she got to have the match. She got a good response. I don't think it was a fantastic response, but she got a good response. She beat Dana Brooke.
Yeah.
A solid debut for her. Here's the question, though, about Bayley. So she was the underdog, the little engine that could, that overcame the odds in NXT, and that's how she got the following. they are instantly putting her in the title picture on the main roster. And I know that Sasha's hurt, and I know they've done this brand split, but I still wonder, this is probably a mistake from the standpoint that she needs to be somebody that fights her way up. The only way I guess you can undo that is if Charlotte cheats to beat her, and then they play it out a long time to where Bayley has to fight, scratch, and claw to get in this position again, and then she takes advantage of it. But it seems a little awkward with that character to instantly put her in a match against the champion, or put her right in.
Right.
She's going to be challenging for that championship here shortly.
Yeah, it's curious because she came up from NXT. She didn't come up from anywhere else on the card. She's not even won a match in WWE proper yet. So if I'm Asuka, I'm sitting in the wings thinking I deserve a women's championship match more than anybody else in the company because I just beat Bayley on Saturday night.
I know, right?
We'll see. We'll see. I was surprised that she came out on Raw. I kind of thought they would put her on Raw and put her on SmackDown and put Nikki on Raw. But I guess I like the dynamic a little bit more with Nikki being on SmackDown and a more wrestling-heavy Divas division. Also she gets to be with John Cena, which is an added benefit. But Nikki's always felt like the Raw Diva, and Bayley's always felt like the SmackDown Diva. So interesting role reversal, but I don't know. I dig it. It's an interesting thought. We'll see what happens with it.
The Dudleys are gone from WWE. So the boy...
That was a shocker, dude.
Yeah.
That was a shocker.
So they were going to do this angle we all thought where Bubba was going to turn on D-Von. And instead, as they're giving this farewell speech, the Shining Stars come out. The Dudleys, beat them both up, 3D, whatnot. And then Anderson and Gallows come out, and they beat the hell out of the Dudleys, giving them both a magic killer, including giving it to D-Von through a table. And that was the official send-off for the Dudleys, who we thought had signed new deals a few weeks back, but come to find out, they never signed the deals, and the two sides just decided to part ways. So the Dudleys are officially free agents, who, by the way, Bubba is already on Twitter challenging Matt and Jeff Hardy and talking about how they should delete. And Matt is on there saying... telling Senior Benjamin to set the field for the final deletion.
Huh. I was surprised. It seemed like the Dudley Boys were really underused in the last year. They were relegated to the pre-show a whole lot. They had one major title feud with the New Day, but that fizzled out after about a month or less. And so I was very surprised about where they were positioned once they came back. I thought they would at least win the titles or win the championships, but they were never given that chance. So it is what it is. I'm surprised to see them leave, though, especially because I believe there was a feud set up between them, and I think that could be interesting.
So
will they be back? I think they'll be back. I think they'll be back in a couple of years. They said they were retiring. They said they were, quote, going out on their own terms. I don't believe that for half a damn second. So, we'll see.
I don't know. I think they'll obviously work some other shows. Whether they go back to TNA, I don't know. And who knows? I mean, both of them, they're in their mid-40s now, and I don't know how much they want to continue being on the road and everything. They've got their school, in Central Florida as well. So
right.
There's some different opportunities that they're going to be afforded right here, and let's see what happens, and never say never when it comes to a WWE return. When it came to Raw, it's becoming glaringly obvious again, especially now that SmackDown is a totally different show from the standpoint of a different roster, that Raw is really starting to feel long again. I mean, it's always kind of felt long anyway, but the 3 hours, it's just too much. I mean, and I'm not trying to complain too much and say, hey, they need to change it. It's not changing, okay? And I'm not exactly sure what the answer is to this problem. But it felt like a long show again. It dragged. I don't think it was bad necessarily, but it wasn't great. And then you go to SmackDown, and, they've got the limited roster, whatever. But, man, they just make it work. And the 2 hours goes by a lot quicker, and it just feels like a fresher show from top to bottom.
That extra hour is so hard to book for on Raw. And even this week's episode, which had the added benefit of intrigue about Balor, the new title situation and how they were going to handle that, some carryover from the feuds from Sunday night, it still felt like a long show. And I really hope that once they bring in this cruiserweight division, that it's not treated like the Divas division, where it's like, oh, or the women's division now, where it's like, oh, we'll have a few matches here and there. But I really want them to, like, take a segment of each Monday Night Raw, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and do something different with the cruiserweights, because and kind of make it its own little mini show inside of the bigger show, because that could really change up what you do on these Monday Night Raw. Now, I think they'll just have a cruiserweight match every week, and that's the quote-unquote cruiserweight division. But again, if you could do something different with that first hour and make it something unique and then lead that into your second and third hours of the normal quote-unquote non-cruiserweights, that would help this show not feel so long and drawn out and like it's more of the same. Because SmackDown this week, nothing that special happened on SmackDown, just some straight-up wrestling. But it felt like a fun show, a lot more compact and a lot more explosive.
By the way, I almost forgot two things. You mentioned the Cruiserweight division. There was a package. Rich Swann, Noam Dar, Brian Kendrick, TJ Perkins were all shown. So they're going to be part of it once it arrives on Raw September 19th. And then we'll get some other guys in it as well. The other is Braun Strowman beat Johnny Knockout, who likes big sweaty men. Because they literally interviewed this dude in the ring before the match. And they go, why are you doing this? And he goes, and it was like this weird thing. He goes, because I like big sweaty men. I was like, what?
Was that in the script, do you think? Did they script him to say that?
I don't know, man. I just know that Saxon was like, oh my God. And it's like walked out of there. And then Braun Strowman just destroyed good old Johnny Knockout. But that was one of the more strange things. I would not be surprised if we find out that was not in the script. But, I mean, well, I can't imagine somebody going against the script, because then you'll never get invited to come back for WWE. So
right.
It had to have been scripted, but my God, that was weird. SmackDown,
weird.
You know, like you said, there was nothing really too overwhelming, but it's just a good wrestling show. You know, you got, they introduced the women's championship. They introduced the tag team championship. So,
which was terrible. That was just a terrible segment, because it was basically like, here, the six of you have this belt and the six of you have these two belts. Like, it just highlighted how weak that roster is to create entire divisions around them.
No, they're basically there. So for the women, they did qualifying matches, and there's going to be a six-pack challenge for the title at Backlash in a few weeks. And then they're doing a tournament for the women. The other story throughout the show was that, so before or as the show began, AJ Styles was bragging about his victory against John Cena. And he was in the locker room, and Dolph Ziggler was sitting there with his head down in his hands, and AJ started to taunt him and said, oh, what's wrong with this guy, huh? Somebody have a bad night? And Dolph went nuts, and they were fighting. And then later on, when the new championships were getting introduced, they were fighting some more. So Daniel Bryan said, fine, you guys want to fight? You can have a fight. So they had the fight later on with the stipulation that if AJ won, he gets a one-on-one match with Dean Ambrose for the championship at Backlash. If Dolph Ziggler wins, then it's a three-way for the title. So these guys go out at the end of the show, and they put on a hell of a match.
Yep.
And AJ Styles wins clean. So Dolph Ziggler, once again, the loser. And at Backlash, we're getting AJ Styles versus Dean Ambrose.
Yeah, I almost wonder if they're going to set up a maybe a Ziggler-Miz feud coming up. I think that's where you go with this next. That would be a solid upper mid-card feud. But it is really sad. A great match by Ziggler. And Styles, obviously. We've praised him already. But it's a shame to see Ziggler lose again and again and again. And so, I don't know. This was Ziggler's chance to break out. It still is his chance to break out. I'm not signing that away completely. But I'm curious to see where they go next. I believe they could put a belt on him, the IC title.
I don't know, man.
I
think they got to turn Ziggler heel almost at this point. They got to do something to explain what is going on with him. Because otherwise, it's kind of strange that they did this whole thing where they're going to try to build him up. And they put him in a championship match at SummerSlam. Then he gets beat, and then he gets beat the next night. So they got to be doing something. By the way, I got a friend of mine whose name I won't say, Augie, and he is like the biggest Dolph Ziggler fan in the world. And let's just say that he was distraught on Monday night instantly hitting Twitter and texting me about, what are they doing to Dolph, man? This is ridiculous, man. He's one of the best wrestlers in the world. And was freaking out. Just freaking out. Oh, it's so great. And there's a lot of people that too did as well. So I don't know where they're going with that. When it comes to heel turns, we did get a Carmella heel turn as she turned on Nikki Bella. So Nikki was back and Carmella didn't like it and beat her up.
It was a very well executed heel turn, and it gave people a reason that they haven't had so far to care about Carmella, because Carmella beat up the diva who came back, who has her own show named after her. So a smart move by the WWE creative team to give Carmella some real character now that we have a women's title that she'll likely be fighting for in the very near future.
By the way, let's give some props to Breezango, who had a fantastic match with American Alpha on this show as well.
I like that team.
Breezango's good, man. They're a good team.
Yeah, they're pretty good. I have to give props to Heath Slater.
Oh my God.
Fantastic backstage segment.
Freaking awesome.
I loved that Miz segment with Heath Slater, because the setup is Heath Slater looking for a tag team partner, right? He wants to be in the division. He wants to fight for the championships. And Daniel Bryan, Shane McMahon said, well, you can, but you have to find somebody willing to work with you, and this will be your absolute last shot at joining the roster because you've got to win the belt. So Slater walks backstage. He runs into the Miz standing there, and he says, Miz, I would love to be partners with you. And the Miz says, yeah, we could do some great work together. And Slater says, I know, man, you're so talented, and you're so good in the ring. And Miz says, thanks, you know, I really appreciate it. Well, he pulls off his hood. Turns out he's been talking on his Bluetooth headphone. And he says to Steven Spielberg at the potential of working on the next Indiana Jones movie, which will obviously be called Indiana Jones and the Temple of Awesome. That's my words, not his. But funny segment. It was timed perfectly. Great comedic timing by Slater and The Miz. I, of course, I'm a huge Miz fan. But Slater is doing some really great work. He found a partner later with Rhino. I hope they do something with Slater. Whether or not he wins the titles, I hope he goes somewhere and continues to do this, because he is like what Santino should have always been. Santino was this comedic character who became so cheesy and corny that you couldn't take him seriously. And what Slater has going for him is that while he is kind of corny at times, he's got a certain level of credibility that other comedic characters haven't always had. So I'd love to see them do something with him and in the lower mid-card. I think it could be a lot of fun.
He's fantastic. The pop that he got when he came out and interrupted Daniel Bryan and Shane McMahon introducing the new championships was incredible. It was incredible, yep. Man. I mean, people were like all into it. And I mean, he's doing fantastic work. I mean, people would kill for this kind of mic time that this dude's getting. And
right.
We'll see what he does, man. I mean, I like that Rhino's like, hey, man, I got a family too. Let's go take care of our families. Like that.
Yeah. It was like sweet. It was like genuinely a sweet moment. And I thought that was really neat.
So good.
Okay, imagine your Jinder Mahal, right? Yeah. Your Jinder Mahal. And 3 weeks ago, you beat Heath Slater to earn your spot back on the main roster. But nobody's seen you or heard from you since then.
He lost a match since then.
Has he? He's off the match since then?
He lost a match since then. I think he did, but yeah. I mean, I don't want to do what you just said and say, imagine your Jinder Mahal. I'd rather not do that, quite honestly. It's just me, though. Speaking of The Miz, let's talk about the segment afterward, after the show. So Talking Smack on the WWE Network, which has become almost must-see programming now. So it's a little half-hour post-game show with Renee Young and Daniel Bryan. And Daniel Bryan just talking off the cuff on here, man. Just the past weeks, he made fun of Brock Lesnar for his part-time schedule. He totally insulted the name of the Universal Championship. He began this week's show when Renee Young asked him how his SummerSlam weekend was by talking about, yeah, I went to this great show called Evolve. It was like in this gringy little building and these great wrestlers. And he's like all into it. So during the show, they were talking to Nikki Bella. She got jumped from behind by Carmella. And finally they got pulled apart. But both Daniel and Renee sold it fantastically well. And then to end the entire show, The Miz came out and got ticked off at Daniel Bryan. He got ticked that he did not have a match on the show. And so The Miz got mad because Daniel's the GM. And Daniel Bryan said, "I don't like the way that you wrestle." He goes, "I respect you, but I don't like the way that you wrestle." And when The Miz questioned why, Daniel said, "Because you wrestle like a coward." And this whole thing was like a tease to whether or not Daniel Bryan would wrestle again, which he's not going to, at least in WWE. He says, because he later, during the middle of this, had said, "I want to wrestle again. They won't let me." But The Miz just went off on this unbelievable in-your-face promo to Daniel Bryan. And he just talked about how Daniel promised the fans he'd be back in a year time. He goes, "But you didn't come back." He goes, "But I'm the coward. I'm the one that doesn't love the fans." And The Miz said, "Well, if you love the business so much, why don't you quit? Why don't you quit and go to the bingo halls with your indie friends?" And Renee was trying to calm him down. And The Miz continued on this great rant where he was talking about how great the Intercontinental Championship is and the lineage of it. And he continued to get in Daniel's face, and he goes, "Oh, because you want to call me a coward, but you're the one that won't get in the ring again," to the point where Daniel walked away, and The Miz continued to chastise him and says, "I'm the one that loves the fans. I'm the one who loves everyone and everything. You're the one that gets up and walks every single time. You're the coward." And it was this unbelievable promo from The Miz that got people talking. I mean, people were hitting everybody up and on social media, talking to me about it, going, "Was this real? Was this a shoot?" Which, to me, it was planned, but it was not a scripted promo. It was, "All right, Miz, right, this is the angle. Now go with it." And The Miz totally went with it. It was unbelievable.
The Miz is doing the best work of his career right now. He has been a former world champion, right? He's been a world champion in the past. He's been IC title champion. He's been tag team champion. He is doing the absolute best work of his career in this character. He's evolved this character so far. He's always been that cocky little whatever guy who you just want to wring his neck. But now he's mastered it. And I think having Maurice with him really sells it. But his mic work is what's doing the most for him. And I the segment you talk about on Talking Smack is a testament to that. He is able to go off the cuff in a way with confidence. The Miz is so confident. He has this air and swagger about him that he's never had before. And I love it. And yes, obviously I'm a huge Miz fan, but I think you have to respect where he's come from and what he's able to do to the fans to make them hate him so much in a genuine way and just manipulate emotion. So obviously we're not going to see Daniel Bryan and The Miz fight again. I would love it. It was not going to happen. But I hope it does lead to bigger and better things for The Miz on SmackDown, because I believe he deserves more.
I think it will, you know, and it's just an interesting storyline that they do. And this is something that I think that's making SmackDown feel a little bit different, is they're really doing these blurred lines of reality. And
yeah,
I like that they do that. I didn't like it in WCW from the standpoint that they did it in hopes of working the boys. You know, this whole thing like, "Oh, nobody knew that this was going to happen," and blah, blah, blah. Here, I mean, it's a storyline, but they're doing it so well with the talent that they have. It's, you know, it really adds another layer to the show. And then when you're talking about SmackDown, it has the advantage of only being a 2-hour show, but they're making the most of the 2 hours. And then you put Daniel Bryan in this Talking Smack segment where he's not afraid to say whatever he wants. He knows there's a line he can't go past, but he's still going to have fun with everything. And he's so genuine that when he says something, you believe it. You believe when he's having fun. He doesn't mind taking cracks at people. But when he is selling something, when he is saying something, you feel that he's being totally honest with you.
Exactly. And I think, you know, we talk about SmackDown being a 2-hour show. SmackDown puts up 3 hours of content every week. Like, the thing about it is, it's not a true 3-hour on television show, but now with a 2-hour SmackDown and the 1-hour Talking Smack, they're up there with just as many hours to fill. However, that third hour being a different format is making for unique programming and you know, buzzworthy stuff buzzworthy segments that you can't handle. Cut all those, in my opinion, cut all those stupid in-ring Jericho, Light Reel, and Miz TV, whatever shows out,
yep.
And do that stuff on Talking Smack, and it will feel a lot more genuine, and like you're saying, it will blur those lines in a very believable way, while still, you know, keeping it contained to where it needs to be contained, and that is to the programming on wrestling.
So let's talk about some of the other quick news items before we get out of here. So there was an interesting thing that happened at the end of SummerSlam. So apparently, Chris Jericho and Brock Lesnar almost came to fists. So after Lesnar won the match and came to the back, apparently, right around that same time, Chris Jericho came to the gorilla position, and he wanted to see if Orton was okay, and he wanted to know what happened, and he wanted to know, was that the planned finish or not? So he was talking to Michael P.S. Hayes and was like, hey, man, was that the finish?
Which, to be fair, Brock Lesnar does have a history of kind of being a wild man.
Oh,
so
yeah.
To assume that he might have went off script a little bit and really beat the tar out of Randy Orton, it's not an unreasonable expectation.
Well, the difference would have been, I think some real wrestlers would have come out there and stopped him, and they have sent out the referees. So, but anyway, so I guess Jericho was talking to Hayes, or as the story goes, he was talking to Hayes, and Hayes would not give him an answer, and Jericho got upset. And at the same time that Jericho had said something like, that's BS, Lesnar came walking through. And Lesnar was like, hey, man, what the hell? And thought he was talking about his match, and he decided to call Chris Jericho a name, which could have been maybe like a here, kitty, 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 and or maybe told him to shut up. And they ended up going face-to-face, screen, you know, exchanging words. They were barking at one another pretty darn good, to the point where I guess Lesnar had pushed Jericho, and Jericho decided to put his forehead right to Lesnar's forehead and push back. And he basically...
That takes cojones.
Yeah. Well, not even more. He shoved Lesnar against the wall. And
takes cojones.
Yeah. So Triple H... And then I guess Lesnar then told him, you need to either punch me or kiss me. And Triple H jumped in to break it up. And then they started getting heated again to where it looked like they're going to throw fists, to where at this time, Vince McMahon got involved and he had to threaten the gun show, I guess, and broke it up. So, by the way,
I go to the gym every night, yes, and catch Pokemon.
I'm out there at 2 o'clock in the morning with my creatine, pal.
ADHD is my blood.
By the way, happy birthday, Vince, who turns a spry 71 today. But anyway, Vince broke it up. At the same time, Jericho was still mad, and Vince said, it's all work. Be professional. And Triple H had said, Lesnar started it. So there was a big old scene. Who knows? I'm like, I don't know exactly what was said or anything like that. But regardless, everybody has the same story from the standpoint that, and I know for a fact, Chris Jericho and Brock Lesnar did exchange words. They did go toe-to-toe, and they damn near fought. But that's where it ended. No punches were exchanged, just some pushing and shoving and screaming and whatnot, and that was that. So
this does not seem like, you know, knowing Chris Jericho, seeing him on TV, that does not seem like his MO to fight another superstar in the back.
But then you go back to the Bill Goldberg story from back in the day, and it definitely feels like it, because Goldberg's a much bigger guy, especially at the time. Remember that at his peak, Bill Goldberg weighed, you know, upwards of 300 pounds. And
right,
Jericho and him got into it. And what did Chris do? Front face lock and took him down. You know, he didn't back down from that dude one bit. That's just kind of Chris's MO, is that he has a certain amount of principles. And if something goes wrong and you want to challenge him on it, especially if you're a bigger guy and you try to bully him, he will get physical and he will not back down. So,
I mean, I think it's admirable that Chris Jericho was looking out for Randy Orton. I don't know their relationship, but I do know that Jericho loves the business. Even though he leaves, he loves the business, and he wants to make sure it's handled properly, and I respect that, you know. Especially Brock Lesnar, he's a professional wrestler, but he's also kind of an outsider. So, you know, it is what it is. I think it's an interesting story, but I'm glad that they didn't get into a big fight. Also, as an aside, Chris Jericho is doing great work with his character right now.
Oh, yeah,
he is. Making everybody hate him. My wife just absolutely cannot stand him. The way he comes out with his scarf and the way he holds his hand and holds his head up. And
the way that he slowly walks. He's got his goatee. All of it.
Yes. It's a good character evolution. Chris Jericho always reinvents himself. And
yeah.
I love where he is right now.
So one other note about Brock Lesnar. So it looks like his potential MMA suspension could be a lot shorter. So he is not facing a 2-year ban. He is facing a maximum of a 1-year suspension. And here's the reason why. So he tested positive for the anti-estrogenic agent hydroxychloroquine, which WADA, which is the World Anti-Doping Agency, considers a specified substance. And under the code, there's a greater likelihood that these specified substances could be susceptible to a credible non-doping explanation. In other words, there's a reason why they could get in your body, and it might not be from a bad substance. They could be in other substances that you digest. So because,
like generic Cialis. Who knew?
Right. It could be from whatever, right? So basically, the WADA code allows, quote, a tribunal more flexibility with making a sanctioning decision. So he faces a 1-year ban maximum, but because it's a specified substance, there could be a lot less. In fact, the minimum sanction he faces is a public warning. So there's a chance he might not even be suspended a day, but at most, he'll be suspended a year. And get this, if he is suspended from USADA, he has the option of appealing to a panel of arbitrators. So he can say, you know what, I don't like this. I want to take this arbitration, and he could challenge it there. And he could possibly win. So there's a lot more to be said about this, but Lesnar's not going to be suspended for 2 years. He might be suspended for a year. It might be 6 months. It might be 3 months. You know, it might be bad, 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 Brock. And he explains where he got it from. And then same thing for John Jones, by the way. But John Jones obviously isn't wrestling, so that's why we're giving it to Lesnar. But it's an interesting note that we talk about Brock that there might be an explanation for why he tested positive on 2 occasions. We could see him back in the octagon sooner than later if, and that's another whole, you know, bag of worms, is that trying to, you know, when does he want to fight again? When would UFC want him to fight again? And would WWE allow him to fight again?
I mean, you talk about a 3-month suspension. That's nothing.
He wasn't going to fight in 3 months anyway.
Right, right.
So
interesting. I would, if that's the case, Brock Lesnar's got to be back in the octagon, right? I mean, that's got to be what happens next because
he'd
be a top 10 fighter in his division, not handily, but on short notice, in an impressive way.
So let's get to one other thing here. So obviously we talked about Finn Balor getting injured, and during the match with Seth Rollins last year, we saw Sting get injured in a match with Seth Rollins. And there's some questions about Seth, you know, when it comes to his style, especially because they're both on like these buckle bombs, right? So WrestleZone got a hold of Bret Hart. And Bret has been pretty vocal about Seth Rollins and his style, especially after the injury to Sting. Oh, and the injury to John Cena as well, because he accidentally broke Cena's nose with a knee, last year as well. Here's what Bret Hart had to say. I take no great pleasure in saying I told you so, but if you're a professional wrestler and you keep hurting opponents and or yourself, clearly you're doing it wrong. I wrestled a very realistic and physical style, and not once in 23 years did I ever hurt one opponent ever. Seth Rollins needs to improve his technique and become the safest wrestler in the business. I have great respect for Seth. I believe he'll improve and hopefully stop hurting the town before someone gets killed. Wrestlers have to trust one another. If a wrestler holds the life of another wrestler in his hands for the sake of his family, wife, or children, you plain and simply cannot drop it. And he went on to say, I saw this coming. Bill Goldberg was very similar. When I think of Samoa Joe nearly killing Tyson Kidd, then see him continuing to use that deadly finish of his, I just shake my head. It's not real. It's only supposed to look real. Wrestlers are not crash test dummies.
So he called out Seth Rollins, Samoa Joe,
and Bill Goldberg.
And Bill Goldberg, all the same breath.
And I totally understand Goldberg, because obviously yep. that's how his career ended. And Bill was very, very physical. He was very physical.
Okay, so no offense, would we call out Owen Hart for this as well? I mean, not to go there because of what happened with Owen, but Owen had a move that was very dangerous. You call out Samoa Joe for using his finisher, and Owen Hart finishing with a pile driver. One of the most dangerous moves in the history of wrestling.
Here's what I would say to Brett, okay, or say about the situation. And I totally understand where Brett is coming from, and he's not wrong. From a standpoint
right.
as you have to work a safe style. And Brett, obviously, you know, tried to make it look extremely realistic, but was, you know, he didn't hurt anybody, and, you know, he always tried to be as safe as possible. When it comes to Joe, I don't think anybody else has really gotten injured. And unfortunately, accidents do happen. Look what happened, you know, with D'Lo Brown and Draws. I mean, accidents happen
yep.
in the ring, unfortunately. And luckily, it did not kill Tyson Kidd. And yes, Joe still uses it, but I think if you watch him, he had used it for years before, and he never seriously hurt anybody. And he's doing it now, and I think he's being ultra safe with it. You can see there's a little bit more rotation when he does the move, so I get it. When it comes to Seth, I think the knee was just unfortunate, you know, when it comes to Cena. When it comes to the buckle bombs, I think that's where you can say, I'm not saying that Seth is careless or bad with his technique. I just think that that's a move that's difficult to take, that you can't totally control the guy once he's airborne and how he hits and where exactly a turnbuckle or the wall hits him. And that would be something that I would look at and say, you know what, let's just cut this one out. We don't have to do this.
And not to beat up on Seth's size, because Seth is a very tall, very physical athlete,
mm-hmm.
but Seth is not the size of somebody like, let's say, The Undertaker or Big Show or Kane, who, when Seth picks a guy up, he's picking a guy up much higher for his body size than somebody like The Undertaker, who can pick a guy up and bring him in the air and still have control over him because he's not above his head as quite as much, you know?
Yeah.
So that's part of the problem. It's hard for Seth to control because Seth is not a huge guy either. So you're picking up these guys who aren't that much smaller than you. That's what makes it dangerous. So I agree. I think that's a move. I love that move. I think it's a great move. But it's called a couple of... Once is enough, right? And you can say Sting was... Maybe he was headed that way anyway because he was an older competitor. But when you injure... When you injure Finn in the same way, I'm just... I don't know.
Well, the tough thing is that, you know, Sting, you know, a little bit older as well. But... Unfortunately, now it happened to Finn. He didn't mean it in either spot. But you know what? At the same time, like I said, it's just a move that's hard to control. So that's why I
right.
look at it and say, you know what? Maybe it's best that we just not do that. Because it'd be one thing if it was something else. It's a move that you could totally control. And it was technique. I don't know how much technique is really into that move. You just pick up a guy and you launch him. And that's where it becomes
Everybody,
tough.
All you people listening, go be a pro wrestler. Just pick up guys and launch them. That's all it takes.
Right. You know, I mean, well, how many times do we look at Titus O'Neil? I'm not saying that Titus O'Neil is a dangerous wrestler, but Titus doesn't know his own strength. And he's picking up guys, and he's literally just whipping them around in the ring and dropping them. Okay?
Yeah.
And he's not trying to hurt anybody. And I don't think he's seriously hurt anybody with that move. But there's no control on that. The only difference between that one and what Seth does is, well, number one, Seth is trying to launch somebody into a turnbuckle, or in the case, the barricade at ringside, but he's also got somebody higher in the air. You know,
yeah.
when it comes to Titus, he's lifting people probably at his waist level, but he's just slinging them around like a sack of potatoes, you know, and letting them fall where they will, you know, sometimes even into the ropes. So,
I mean, Titus might not have hurt anybody with his finisher, but he hurt some people with that promo on Monday night. My God, that thing was awful. Dear Lord. Like, how many times did he screw up? He was like, it was just bad all the way around.
That was rough. Yeah, I probably should include that. I was being nice to Titus there. I did not include that, but yeah, that was...
I like Titus.
I know, Titus is a great guy, man. But, yeah, that was... That's one of those, especially for somebody that's a good guy, you're like, oh, no, no, dude. It's like, hit eject.
And he just kept making it worse. He just kept saying, like, the wrong, like you said, you instead of me, tonight instead of last night. Poor guy.
And
you're going to give him a hug, you know?
You're on live TV, you know, you can't just hit the eject, you know, it's just like, you got to power through it somehow, man.
Yep.
You got to find your way, and it's, man, that could be tough. That could be tough. So,
like this podcast. We just got to keep... you don't give me a second chance. You don't give me a do-over.
That's true.
We just keep powering through.
Got to power through, man. Make it happen. So it's the power of positivity, my friend. Oh, by the way, glad to see that Big E is back, and he has both of his nuts.
That's right. The Xavier Wood and Kofi Kingston, a couple of nuts.
There you go.
These guys are crazy.
I think we're going to wrap it up right there, but a couple of reminders. Please check out the YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/betweentheropes. You can see the various interviews with with the talent that we spoke with in WWE, from the likes of Bill Goldberg and AJ Styles, Shinsuke Nakamura, Sasha Banks, Sheamus. Check all those out on the YouTube page. And then please subscribe to the podcast. You can do it on iTunes or on Stitcher. Rate and review the podcast. You will also find it on SoundCloud. You can find it on the TuneIn app, on Google Play, all these different places. Please check out the podcast and subscribe to it and spread the word to everybody else about the podcast as well. Follow us on Twitter. You can follow the show at Between the Ropes. You can follow me individually at Brian Fritz, and you can follow Michael at The Real Wiseman. In fact, go out of your way to really follow Michael. He needs some followers, don't you?
I do. And don't just follow me individually. Follow me in bulk. That's what I want.
Follow you in bulk, yes. Get all the spam bots you can to follow Michael.
Let's do it.
So, thanks again, everybody.
Whatever it takes.
Yes, exactly. So, it looks like I'll have another podcast later on in the week. I'm hoping to. In fact, there might be two because I might take all the interviews that we did from SummerSlam and put them here on the podcast as well. So, if I don't do that, or even if I do, check them on. You can see my facial expressions talking to these different people, including Sheamus putting me in a bear hug, basically. And Bill Goldberg giving me a death stare when I asked him a question where I thought he might try to pull my head off. So check all that out. Thanks again, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.
The talking is over.
Thanks for downloading Between the Ropes.
Hey, you guys are awesome. Thank you.
For more, go to BetweenTheRopes.com and subscribe to Between the Ropes on iTunes.
Thank you.
Have a nice day.